Welcome to our Day 7 preview from the 2018 US Open. I'm Peter Hodges with Ravi Uber. A special welcome to tennis fans around the world listening on Courtside, the official podcast of the US Open, where we've completed our review of Day 6. Now we look forward to Day 7, and we start things off with Serena Williams against Kaia Kanepi. Of course, Kanepi beating Simona Halep what seems like almost moons ago. But she's very dangerous, is Kaia Kanepi. Do you see a chance of an upset once again?
Always a chance she has, because she's such a big hitter of the ball, Pete. And anytime you can bash the ball the way that Kanepi does, you do have a chance. She's never beaten Serena before, but this is a free hit for her, right? Nobody expects her to win. At the end of the day, it's going to be hard for her to win, because the way Serena went past Venus, who she always calls her toughest opponent, I mean, that's going to give Serena so much confidence. And I felt she served really, really well, Serena. And also, she moved well, taking into consideration, especially, she rolled her ankle early part of the first set. So that is one thing to keep an eye on. You know, she was able to move fairly smoothly after rolling her ankle, but sometimes, you know, the effects can only be felt the day after. So it's going to be interesting to see how Serena does move in this one. But if she's going to be moving okay, if she's 100% or close to it, you'd expect her to get through, especially built on the momentum she had on beating Venus.
And of course, Kanepi, a big ball striker, not particularly known for her movement on the court. What type of player do you think Serena Williams would want to face ideally? Does she prefer facing the quicker, better movers these days, or is it the bigger ball strikers?
Well, let's go back to Wimbledon, because on the path to that Wimbledon final, all along the way until she got to the final, she basically played big hitters like a Kanepi. And I think she really likes that, because, you know, those players like Angelique Kerber, they just get every single ball back. They do have the ability to move Serena around the court, and they tend to extend the rallies. With these big hitters, the rallies tend to be a little bit shorter. I think that plays into Serena's hands. It turns into like a power game, a power matchup, which Serena is so good at. And, you know, Serena is also, we talk about the serve, we talk about what a good athlete she is, but she's an excellent returner. So I think she's going to have some joy returning as well on the Kanepi serve. And again, based on the performance against Venus, and the crowd is going to be so behind Serena, it's going to be very difficult for Kanepi to pull off this massive upset after she beat Halep in the first round.
And of course, another one of the American women in action, Sloane Stephens, the defending champion, taking on Elise Mertens, looking to reverse the result of a week or so ago in Cincinnati, where it was the Belgian who got the better of Stephens. And after her previous round win, Stephens was saying just how happy she was to be still in the hat and still with a chance of winning this title again.
Yeah, very happy to be through. Obviously a little rocky in the second set, but I thought I started off well, and I played a solid match, so I was happy with that. And the fight was good throughout, so really pleased.
Yeah, really pleased indeed. And Stephens in particular, Ravi, has been so impressive. I mean, has won in different ways. Is that what has been so impressive?
It has been. You know, there was things said about her in the past when she was just coming up through the ranks about the intensity, that she lacked a bit of intensity, that she didn't show enough fire on the court, but that's all been banished. And, you know, she won the U.S. Open last year, coming in this year with the pressure of defending that massive title. And I think she's acquitted herself very, very well. And going to this particular matchup, she said that when they met in Cincinnati, she was very tired off the back of that run in Montreal when she made the final, lost that epic final to Simona Halep. So I think she's not going to necessarily look into that result too much, but Merton is going to draw confidence on that. Now, it may be the case that Stephens was fatigued in that match. However, Merton is not going to be thinking about that. She's going to be thinking, you know what, I beat her, so I can do it again.
Also, in the women's draw, we've got Karolina Pliskova against Ashley Barty. And this is an intriguing matchup, because two players we haven't really talked about. Of course, the women's draw is wide open with who's going to come through. But Pliskova, former world number one, former finalist here, but no one's really talking about her to perhaps go the whole way and win the title.
Yeah, rightfully so, because she has not had a good build-up at all. This is somebody who was number one this time last year and playing such good tennis. She was expected to do big things. She made the final in 2016 in New York. So she's kind of fallen off. That's been evidence where her ranking is now. She's had some coaching changes, cutting ties with Tomas Krupa, and then with Renee Stubbs, and then here at the U.S. Open with Conchita Martinez. So, I mean, there has been a bit of flux in her game and also in her coaching setup. But As she put it, after her win in the previous round, she feels she's super confident. And as for Ash Barty, you just love her progression. She's got so many elements in her game, so many things she can do with the ball, knocking on the door of making a slam quarterfinal. So I think this is going to be a really good matchup.
Yeah, and Plisheva also spoke after her previous round win about her opponent.
We played, I think, somewhere in Asia last year, so very close match. I don't remember. I lost for sure. But yeah, she's a tough opponent because she has so many options what to play. She's using a lot of slice, coming to the net very often. She can serve pretty well, so there's a lot of things what she can do, what she can change. So it's going to be tough, completely different than today, but I still have to play my game. My serve got improved from my first match, so hopefully it can stay. And if I serve well, I think there's always a chance to beat those girls.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating, that one. We'll see plenty of winners between those two, perhaps plenty of aces too. They're always almost guaranteed aces with Karolina Plíšková. As for the men, incidentally, Rafael Nadal kicks things off over on the Arthur Ashe Stadium court midday the time. He takes on Nicolas Basilashvili, who's having a terrific year. Doesn't have that many power shots to his game in terms of Basilashvili. How do you see him winning this one?
I think he's actually a very good striker of the ball. He can generate pace, however, I think you're alluding to the fact that if you compare him to Karen Khachanov, well, it's much different in terms of the pace because Khachanov is such a massive, massive hitter. I'm just looking for, Pete, how Nadal moves in this one, how the knee is going to be, because we know that they were strapping to the knee in that win over Khachanov, and that's obviously very worrying for a guy who's always had problems with the knee. And if you look at the time he's scheduled to play, he's going to be first on Ash. Now, when I saw that, I thought to myself, that could be a good sign for Rafa, because if there was something really bothering him with the knee, I'm pretty sure they would have gone to the organizers and said, okay, can you put me on as late as possible to just give me a bit more time to recover or get ready. But the fact that he is playing first up on Ash, maybe it's a good sign. Now, if the knee is okay, you would really expect him to get through against Basilashvili because he doesn't have the same firepower as Khachanov. And Nadal's so good. He's so good at making adjustments. He's done it his whole career. He's won 17 Grand Slam titles. So if the knee is okay, yeah, virtually I would say a little chance of a massive upset happening.
So, of course, Nadal is the top seed in the top half of the draw, the second highest ranked seed in the draw. In that section is Juan Martín Del Potro, and with Nadal playing in the day, if you're smart enough, you can work out that means Del Potro's match is in the evening. He's second up in the night session on the Arthur Ashe Stadium court, and he takes on Borna Coric, who's had a really impressive year. I mean, there was so much written about him. Of course, he had a lot of early results in his career, beating the likes of Murray, beating Nadal, and then he almost flattered to deceive. He plateaued.
Yep.
What's been the difference for him this year?
I think the busy part that he had to the start of the year actually cost him a little bit, because he's still a very young player. So when he played so well in Indian Wells in Miami, it didn't seem like he recovered from that. I think he was something like 7-9 after that, if you disclude Halle. And of course, he won the title in Halle. So he actually said that after he exited at Wimbledon, winning in Halle was more than he thought that was going to happen. And I think he was just ill-prepared mentally to go in and handle Wimbledon. It's been a pretty nice response for him building into the U.S. Open. Actually played Nick Kyrgios, one of the matches on the way to the U.S. Open, and he had a good win. Good win in the last round against Daniil Medvedev. They've actually faced off quite a few times recently. Medvedev got him at Wimbledon, if I recall, and thereafter Coric had beaten him. So that's a good win for the Winston-Salem champion. So he's playing good tennis. He said in his career, early in his career, he kind of compared his game to Djokovic, which raised a few eyebrows because people thought he was saying he was as good, which I don't think he was. But game style similar, and you can see why. But Delpo, fan favorite, loves playing in New York and playing such good tennis.
Yeah, that one should be really intriguing. Another really intriguing matchup, similar to almost the Barty Plíšková, in fact, that no one's really talking about them, is Dominic Thiem against Kevin Anderson. And Thiem spoke after his previous match win about being very hopeful of possibly getting through to the last eight.
I didn't have any good experiences yet in the fourth round, so I don't rely on them. And it's always something special for me to reach the second round of a slam. And let's see how I play, but one thing is for sure, that I will give everything to maybe make the first quarter here.
And the only match that we've missed out on in terms of the men's side of the draw is Isner versus Raonic. A battle of the big servers, of course, an American versus a Canadian. Should be fascinating, that one. There's so much going on, though, of course, around the grounds in New York. It's an action-packed days once again, and it gets underway at 11 a.m. on the Louis Armstrong Stadium court. If you can tune in to us, please do so, because this is the place to be. And that's our Day 7 preview from Ravi Uber. I'm Pete Hodges. Thanks for listening. Join us for complete live coverage every day on US Open Radio, presented by American Express. You can find us on usopen.org or the US Open app.
This year on Courtside, the official podcast of the US Open, we're doing special interviews to go behind the scenes at the US Open. And today I'm happy to say I'm joined by Michael Feuer. He's the executive producer of US Open Entertainment and Special Events, and he helps run the showpiece of the US Open. We all know the tennis so well, but first what I want to ask Michael about is opening night, which was spectacular. It has grown over the years and included a beautiful evening, lots of dignitaries, and also a pretty awesome show with Kelly Clarkson. How did you get Kelly Clarkson? That was a pretty good get, by the way.
It was totally a team effort. There's a lot of people behind the scenes that make this happen. And there was a lot of pressure to deliver for the 50th anniversary this year. And we knew it had to be epic. And we got really lucky in that Kelly said yes and delivered what many are calling was a Super Bowl halftime show-like performance.
There's a lot of calls actually on social media for Kelly to do the Super Bowl, hopefully down the road. But I like that you brought up 50 years because you had Billie Jean King and Virginia Wade out on stage with Katrina Adams before Kelly. And that was actually the final in 1968, the first Open of the Open era.
Right, as well as Tom Ocker, who was the men's finalist. And of course Arthur was represented by his family that night. So we thought, you know, we struggled a lot. Behind you on the wall is a picture of the 40th anniversary where we tried to get everyone here. And in 1997, I'm dating myself, produced the opening ceremony of Arthur Ashe Stadium, and we tried to get everyone then. And we really thought about it and thought, you know what, if we're not able to get all 49 living champions in one place at one time, which we thought the odds were pretty small, let's spread it out over the course of the 3 weeks of the Open now, including Fan Week and then the main draw, and celebrate all 50 champions in many different ways. So yesterday morning, Virginia Wade was greeting fans outside the gate as they were waiting to come in. Earlier in the week, Mats Wilander was out there. We had Lindsay Davenport and Arantxa out playing in a Legends match last week. We'll have other players doing coin tosses over the course of the coming week on center court in Arthur Ashe Stadium. So beginning, we thought, let's begin at the beginning, and had Billy, who's been a part of opening night almost every year since her name went on the entire facility, and of course her having been the finalist that year, along with Virginia, who won, and then Tom Ocker, who we haven't seen at the U.S. Open in a long time, made it appropriate. Without having to, you know, try and assemble 49 people in one place.
Yeah, fewer moving pieces. It was a wonderful night, obviously, to remember the tennis that's been played, to celebrate arts and culture with Kelly being a part of it, and then, of course, with Serena Williams walking out on court that night as well. Rafael Nadal, champion, current champions, past champions. Now, I've done a not very good job of explaining your job, but can you just give people an overview? I want to next dive into Arthur Ashe Kids Day, but there's a lot of different moving pieces for your role as executive producer of US Open Entertainment and Special Events.
Sure. You know, it's grown from, I remember the time we first added video boards as a permanent part of Arthur Ashe Stadium. In 1997, when we produced the opening ceremony, the video boards were here for Arthur Ashe Kids Day and opening night, and then they went away for the rest of the tournament. I also remember the first time that either Pete Sampras or Andre Agassi set foot on court on Arthur Ashe Stadium, and players had the prerogative to say they didn't want the match footage played on the screen at the time. And they were the only two that were old school, and then since then, it's always the matches have always played the video in Arthur Ashe Stadium. But from the operation of the video boards to the scoring that appears, you know, working closely with SMT, who's the company that handles all the data. I mean, there are so many moving parts behind the scenes to what the fans ultimately see. So you have editors who are putting together, you know, video footage to people who are running the boards that have the information that you're reading, whether we're posting where fans can be watching players practicing to what the scores of matches are, to seeing live matches, the video board in the South Plaza now. You can be sitting out by the fountains enjoying a Honey Deuce or a
yes,
Heineken.
Right.
And you can be watching three matches at the same time,
right?
Which is pretty incredible. That's one piece of it. The announcers. So we have operations on the four show courts, which is Arthur Ashe Stadium, the new Louis Armstrong Stadium, Grandstand, which is now just a couple of years old, and Court 17. And so each of those stadiums has an MC host announcer who is on court or in a booth talking to the fans, introducing the players, part of the energy and excitement that is now the Open. We play music on all four of those courts. As you know, having been there yourself,
yes,
on Court 17, the person who's the announcer is also the producer, the director, and the DJ playing music off of an iPod.
Yeah.
In the other three stadiums, we now have full-time DJs, full-time producers, full-time directors to complete the operation. So there's a lot to, you know, what the fans see and hear in between the tennis. Tennis we have no say in, but everything else that happens around it, from getting the players onto the court to their pre-match interviews to their post-match interviews, to some of the sponsor activities that happen, like today's Polo Ralph Lauren Day, and balls were hit into the crowd between matches so that fans could win prizes, that type of activity.
Yeah, so much going on. I've actually done that role now a couple times with you. I was on Court 17 and then on Grandstand. And it's just fun to, you know, because people are here to watch tennis, obviously. But I think what I'm hearing from you, too, is that this is an experience, right? And you're busy. You've got emails coming in. We're sitting in your office where there's so much paraphernalia from years past of trying to expand the U.S. Open just beyond the tennis itself. If I can switch gears just a little bit and talk about Arthur Ashe Kids Day, which has grown into a behemoth production. I'll let you talk about what happened this year, but in the past you've had Carly Rae Jepsen, Justin Bieber, Rihanna, Britney Spears has been here, the Backstreet Boys. And it's become a celebration of kids, of youth tennis, of Net Generation, which is now the activation that the USTA uses to help grow the game for young kids. But that is a huge production, especially because it's a live TV event. Or is it a tape TV event? It's a TV event.
It's a TV event. So first of all, this year we had almost a record 33,000 people on the grounds on Arthur Ashe Kids Day. So the day begins with a free 4-hour morning program of all kinds of activities, from, you know, getting on a court, and we have things for every age of beginner, intermediate, advanced, all through the Net Generation program. We have face painters and hair braiders. You should go out and think about getting your hair braided next year. A little braid in there.
I'll do one. Sure.
A little American flag on your cheek. And, you know, it's just fun for kids and for the families. They can get on court. You get kids who've never held a racket before, which is, of course, the goal. And then the ticketed stadium show was again sold out for the 10th year in a row. And, you know, ranges in the acts, like you've talked about, who've been here in the past, to this year we had a bunch of breaking acts. A.J. Mitchell, who, you know, is trying to be the next Shawn Mendes, and in real life that's wanting to be the next boy band, and Kim Petras, who's a rising star. And then CNCO was our discovery, who are a Latin boy band, who just one of their videos alone, Reggaeton Lento, has 1.5 billion views for that one video.
Wow.
And combined, they have something like 50 million followers on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. And I know part of the USTA's mission is to take tennis to communities that have not had tennis before. And the Hispanic community has been a big, important part of the outreach. And so it was really great for the first time to have not only CNCO, but also in real life, who sing also in English and Spanish, to have two groups singing in Spanish at Arthur Ashe Kids Day. And of course, it is a platform for Net Generation. And at the end of the day, it's also all about paying tribute to Arthur Ashe. And what we say each year is that we want to be sure that people understand why there's an event named for Arthur Ashe and why there's a stadium named for Arthur Ashe, and that it's just not like Labor Day where you have the day off, but you don't know why. Hmm. And so it's important to remember Arthur's values, what he did on the court, but also what he did off the court. And part of the way we brought that all together this year was the finale of our show, which involved kids from the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. And we thought that their message about empowering young people, about positive change through action, was a perfect match for Arthur's philosophy. Mm. And we brought together the entire cast of Arthur Ashe Kids Day for the finale to sing the song written by these high school students, which we thought was a pretty powerful moment.
Yeah, no, I thought it was very powerful. I got to see, I didn't get to see the whole show. I definitely got to see that part. I want to close out our conversation. We've talked about on-court entertainment, opening ceremony, Kelly Clarkson, Arthur Ashe Kids Day. There's just a lot of moving pieces. You also help coordinate a lot of the celebrity appearances that happen here that you people at home see on TV. You've had great celeb turnout. You help with the Fed and Davis Cups with the USTA throughout the years. But this is a, we're speaking to you in an office that's full of people that's helping. I mean, there's a lot of moving pieces to the entertainment piece. And I wrote on my notes, quote, the show, because that's
right.
What you consider it. It's not just coming out to see, we're all here to see the tennis, but coming out to have a great day and to be entertained and to listen to good music and feel like you're a part of this greater US Open community.
You know, we're on the front line, and so we tend to get a little bit of applause, and we get to do the sexy stuff, but we couldn't do what we do without an army of people in the legal department doing the contracts, in the finance department getting everybody paid, the public relations side, the marketing side, all the people at the tennis center who run the operations, the security. I mean, there are so many moving parts to an event of this magnitude. And I've had people who work with us on the Super Bowl come out here, and they're like, you're putting on a Super Bowl every day for 14 days in 17 stadiums. And, of course, you know, throughout the grounds. You know, between Arthur Ashe Stadium and the new Louis Armstrong Stadium and all the other people on the grounds, you know, you're talking tens of thousands of people on site every day.
Wow.
And what you want to leave them with is, you know, a great experience that extends beyond the tennis, beyond the entertainment. But it really has become, you know, sports and entertainment having merged. But we couldn't do what we do, which again is the fun stuff, without so many other people.
Okay, I just thought of this. I'm going to put you on the spot. What's the one thing you're most proud of? The one moment, the one maybe celebrity get, the one, you know, you do a lot of reaching out and wanting people to be a part of the U.S. Open. Is there one moment that sticks out to you? You've had a lot, which is good.
I will go to the most current, which getting to meet Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reed last night. Who are championing social justice.
Yeah.
It's funny, I don't have it on right now because I gave it away, but Serena has her S pins she's been giving out for her new brand. And the box says, what's your S for? And I was going to pick Sassy, but that was taken. So I opted for Social Justice.
Yeah.
So appropriately, circling back, in terms of what Colin and Eric stand for, in terms of social justice right now, that was pretty awesome. I mean, I've met a lot of fun people. I've met big name people. I've met Olympic athletes.
Michelle Obama's on your wall behind you.
Yeah, that was pretty good. That was pretty good. That was pretty epic. She might come a close second to Colin and Eric.
Yeah.
But you know what? It's what have been the most amazing moments were when something like Arthur's brother, Johnny, who was with us for a number of nights last week, will be back again for Military Appreciation Day on Monday, and we'll be back for the men's final, which is the 50th anniversary to the day of Arthur's win.
Wow.
And when he said thank you for all you do to keep Arthur's memory alive and what he stood for, meant more to me than, you know, meeting lots of fancy people with fancy names.
Yeah, and I also have to say the roar that went out when they showed Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reed in Arthur Ashe last night was, I don't think I've ever heard anything like that. It was incredible.
Yeah, that's what people are saying, that it was the loudest ovation of the night, more so than for Serena or Venus, and that they've heard in a long time. Walking in the hallway, people weren't stopping and asking for autographs or pictures. They were stopping and applauding.
Hmm. Wow. Michael Feuer, thank you so much for joining us on Courtside.
Thank you.
Celebrating 50 years of the U.S. Open with Yvonne Lendl.
Yvonne, let's go to Super Saturday, 1984. You're part of one of the great days in tennis history, and I don't know whether it was something you stopped to reflect upon at the time or not, but you kind of opened the day after the senior final with Newcomb and Smith, and you came from match point down against Pat Cash. What are your recollections of that recovery and the great lob you played when you were down match point to come back and beat Pat Cash?
Well, he came in and I hit an average pass, and I thought he was going to punch the volley away, and I didn't even have my racket ready properly. And then all of a sudden I realized I can get it, and I lobbed him with a backhand grip on my forehand. That's what I remember from that.
And how did you execute it so well with the wrong grip?
I think you rely on your instinct and improvise. That's how the matches go most of the time anyway.
Yeah. So, Yvonne, before we get on to the final with John, have you thought since about the gratification of being part of such a great day? Because obviously it ended with McEnroe and Connors, and after your match, Navratilova and Everett played a great women's final. So it was a really spectacular day of tennis that many consider the greatest single day in the history of the sport. Have you thought about that in terms of your own involvement in it?
You know, better than that, Steve. Obviously, I'm aware of that, but I'm not, you know, me well enough to know that I'm not a person who sits back and says, oh, yeah, I was part of that.
Right.
Yeah, it's fun to kind of talk about it when somebody brings it up, but I do not sit back and think about it at all.
So, Yvonne, that was a difficult five-setter. McEnroe played Connors deep into the night, and yet he looked very fresh the next day. You had beaten him at the French, obviously, for your first major in the match we both alluded to. But what happened that day? Was it a case that John was just razor sharp and at his best serving and volleying and just all over you? Or were you disappointed in your performance? How did you feel about that one? Because John beat you.
I was pretty stiff. I was not on top of my physical conditioning. And I think you have to realize that if you have two guys who are tired, the guy who is coming forward has bigger advantage. And John certainly made the best of it.
So a year later, Yvonne, there you are with John again. This time it was your day, your breakthrough. You played what many of us thought was maybe one of the best matches in your career. And I remember you said later that you thought you could make any shot, get to any ball. You had that feeling that day. Yet it didn't start that well. You were down 2-5, set point down on your serve, and you stormed back to win 7-6, 6-3, 6-4. How do you rate that performance so many years later?
Yeah, that was one of the few times I got into the zone. It's very difficult to get into the zone. If you talk to most people, they can tell you that they're able to get into a sub-zone. But into the zone itself, it's very, very difficult. And I was able to get there during that match. And you're right, I was down 2-5 and set point on my serve. And after that, I felt like I was flying out there. But I think we need to back up a little bit. Also, that summer I got beat by John in Montreal, and we had, I think, unfinished match, or he beat me in Stratton. And John had quite a good year that year. And so I think he came into the match as the favorite. Once I got ahead of it, as I said, I was in the zone and felt great.
And did you sense that maybe he was a little debilitated from his five-set match with Bielinger, which was a very hot day the day before, or do you think that had little to do with it?
I have no idea. I didn't realize now, obviously, that he had played five sets until he told me. But I looked at it. I looked at it in the past. What the record is of the guys who played the first semis against the guys who played the second semis, and what the record is of the guys who play five sets against the guys who play three sets in the semis.
Yep.
And it's about 50-50.
That's true.
I don't think there is any distinct advantage, even though logic would dictate if you play first match and play straight sets and the other guy plays five sets and plays late, you should have the advantage, which could have been the case, the following year when I beat Mathieu after he beat Boris in five sets. I beat Stefan in the semis in straight sets, and Boris and Mathieu played five sets, and Mathieu won that, and he had nothing left. For every case like that, you can find another one which is opposite. It's the opposite.
But the bottom line is, as you just said, and I think most observers would absolutely concur, you were definitely in the zone in that final against John in 85.
Yeah, and it was fun.
So, Ivan, by 86, you really had clearly established yourself as the best player in the world. You seemed so comfortable having moved into that role and gotten to the top, and 85 Open was a turning point, and you just kept going, and you were having a great 86 season. And as you just alluded to, you beat Miloslav Mathieu really comfortably in the final after he had the long semifinal. Do you remember being particularly confident about defending the title no matter who you played that year? What are your feelings looking back on that one? Because I think it was sort of right smack in the middle of your prime.
Yeah, I think 86, 87 were my best years. And I wouldn't go and say I was extremely confident defending the title. I didn't even look at it like I'm defending the title. There is nothing you can do about the past, whether it's good or bad. There is only things you can do about your future. So why worry about the past?
Absolutely. But you did. You certainly came out ready to play in that final. And whether or not Mathieu was not 100% himself, you again looked like you were in pretty much in peak form. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think I was ready to play pretty much the entire season. I was healthy. I was feeling good. I had great coaching. I had great training blocks. I had a good year.
So, Ivan, let's go to the next year, 1987, and now you're playing your formidable rival, Mats Wielander. You had a terrific rivalry with him. It was interesting contrast. Mats with his two-hander and his quickness and his counterattacking, and you trying to overpower him. And now you're playing him in the finals in 87 in a match that had been delayed by it rained out on Sunday. You're playing on Monday, and you were not feeling 100% by any means. Give me your thoughts on that contest.
Yeah, I think I was extremely fortunate that the match got delayed by one day, because I wasn't feeling well, and during the rain delay on Sunday, I just slept there. I had a pretty good case of the flu, and I felt a little bit better on Monday, and I was very lucky and very pleased that it didn't go five sets and that one of the sets was quick. Also, we played at night, which was a big advantage. If you don't feel well, it's easier to play later in the day than during the midday sun. And I was very lucky. That's what I was alluding to earlier, that in order to win, you also have to be lucky sometimes. In any match, and especially big match, if you split set and you're going close to the tiebreaker or into the tiebreaker in the third, I think that's the most important juncture of the match.
So the following year, Ivan, you play Mats again, And he was having his greatest year, as you know. He had won two of the three majors. He'd lost at Wimbledon. But now he was trying to claim that U.S. Open crown, add that to his resume. And you guys had a titanic five-setter. Seemed to most of us, and I don't know how it felt to you on the court, that Mats had made it a shift in his game, and he attacked a lot more, came in 131 times to the net, and certainly tried to apply pressure in a way that we, to a degree we'd never seen before. Was that the reason he won? Was it that you were maybe not quite at your peak? It was a great match, 6-4 in the fifth to Mats. What do you remember about that one?
Well, I think the reason Mats won that match is because he played better than I did. It was a close match, and it was razors in margin. But I will have to say that this time I was prepared for him to be aggressive, because he did that to me at the French Open in 1985, where I didn't expect it and caught me by surprise. So I knew that he is going to try to do that, because if he just stays back, the chances were that I was going to win somehow. So I was prepared for that. However, he did really well with his backhand slice. He hit some good volleys. I remember I missed some passes by inches. And as I said, it was razor thin, but the bottom line is he played a little better than I did. I thought it was a very good match.
Oh, it was. It was terrific. But you also kept fighting back, Ivan. He had just set in 4-1. You won the second set. He won the third, and he went up 4-3, 30-love in the fourth, and you came back and won that. And then finally, in the fifth, he had you 2-love, and you won three games in a row. It just seems like you were on the verge of it. With a little bit of luck, you would have won that match. Is that correct?
Well, I don't want to say that if I had a little more luck that I would have won. But as I said, it was really close, and he played really well under pressure.
So, Ivan, your Open career concluded in 94. You had a remarkable success on those courts and at that venue. Did it ever bother you? It's hard for the public, hard to know as a reporter from my standpoint or what the fans were thinking, but often you would play Connors, McEnroe. They were the Americans. You didn't become a citizen until 92. But how did you feel about the crowd reaction to you as a great player? Did you feel you were sometimes perhaps taken for granted?
Never really bothered with it too much. I mean, if you go and play a big event against any player in any country, you need to expect that people are going to root for your opponent. If you play Davis Cup in Argentina, doesn't matter how popular you are there, they're still going to root for José Luis Clerc and Chile Mubila. However, if you play Davis Cup in Prague, I expect the people to support the home team. And that's what it is. If it was Czech Open, which was a major, and it was played in Prague, it would be the other way around for sure.
But as you look back, Ivan, at all those Opens, you know, and starting in 79 and ending in 94, is there one memory that stands out to you that might help the listeners in this podcast understand, you know, who you were and what you felt you stood for as a player? Because I know the players that you've talked about that you admire the most, and you talk about people like Labor and Sampras and the classy individuals. Is that the trait that stands out in your mind that how you wanted to convey yourself as a competitor?
Well, I think that's not a question for me, obviously. But what you want to do is you want to make it part of your game, and part of your, maybe intimidation is the wrong word, but part of your fear the opponents have that you never give up. And whether it is playing at the Open and losing 2 sets to love down to Pete and coming back, or as you mentioned, the match with Matt coming back all the time, or losing 2 sets to Vitas but still losing the match in 5. I think that's what you want as a player, because you can live with no regrets. And I think people remember that as well.
So is there one prominent memory that stands out for you that was most satisfying for somebody who won the tournament 3 times and did so well so many other years? Was it the first title? Was it the last title? What would you cite?
It's always the first title for me. I know Pete may tell you differently, because his last title came at US Open very unexpected. At that time, he hasn't won in over a year, and all of a sudden he wins the US Open as his last match of his career. But for me, whether it was the French or the Australian or the ATP Tour or US Open, it's always the first one, because the first one is special. Now that we talked about it as well. I played a really good match against John, who was the favorite. I played in the zone and felt like I can do anything. And it was a fantastic feeling, and then winning on top of it.
Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. Thank you for listening all year to our celebration of 50 years of the U.S. Open.